Hi, I'm Tim Hernandez. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. I have two very special guests today. The first one we'll be speaking with is novelist Carly Moore, who will be on the phone with us from New York City. And we'll be talking with her about her fantastic and hard-hitting, in fact, incredible novel called The Knot Wives. Carly is an essayist, novelist, and poet. 16 Pills is her first collection of essays, and The Knot Wives is her debut novel. She's a professor of writing and contemporary culture and creative production at NYU. She's also a professor at Bard College's Institute for Writing and Thinking. And then after Carly, joining me here in the studio, will be El Paso-based activist and professor Diana Martinez, and we'll be discussing an exciting new upcoming documentary film called Witness at Tornillo. That'll be showing here in El Paso in the next coming days and I think a couple of weeks ahead. All that and more coming up right now on Words on a Wire. Carly, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So you are phoning us in from New York City, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Awesome. Well, congratulations on The Knot Wives, on the publication of your debut novel, published by Feminist Press. It just came out about a month ago now?
It came out September 10th, and thank you.
Absolutely.
It's been really great having it out in the world.
Good, and I'm excited to get into the book with you and to share that with our listeners. Is it a rumor, or is it true that you will be coming this way toward El Paso soon?
Yeah, I'm coming to El Paso. I'll be reading and doing a talk at UTEP on Thursday night. I think
awesome.
That's November 21st. And then I'll be doing a reading at Literary Bookshop on Friday the 22nd.
That is great.
So I will be coming to El Paso. I'm really excited.
Oh, wonderful. Have you ever been to El Paso before?
I have. I have good friends that teach at UTEP.
Yes.
And so I visited them actually probably at this point like 15 years ago, but I'm really excited to come back.
Yeah, well, we're excited to have you here in our city. So that's going to be really good coming up for our listeners. If you are interested after hearing the interview with Carly about her book, if you're interested, you definitely have two opportunities to come and check her out here at UTEP and at Literary on November 21st. But let's get into the book, Carly. It's really imaginative. And as I said, I guess the word I used was hard hitting, the phrase I used, but it's really kind of a pulls no punches narrative that follows the lives of three main characters, specifically Stevie, who's the central character. And it's really about these three women who are sort of navigating their lives, and they have different sort of things happening in their lives during the time of Occupy Wall Street, which is, you know, I guess circa 2012 or 11?
2011, yeah.
Okay, yeah. And so how would you describe the book for our listeners?
Well, I think you gave a good overview of the three female characters. So there's Stevie, the protagonist, who's a non-tenured professor and going through a divorce and learning how to be single. She's also a mother.
Mm-hmm.
There's her best friend, Mel, who's a bartender, and she's in a relationship with a woman, and
right. She
is trying to open up her relationship, and then the two of them meet up with Johanna, who's a homeless punk anarchist girl who's living in the park.
Yes, right.
And they all sort of converge at Occupy, among other places in the city, but that's sort of a central feature of the book.
Right.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the title, The Knot Wives, is really my attempt to create narratives about women that I know well or that I think don't often get represented in contemporary literary fiction.
Right.
So bisexual and queer women,
right.
Women who are sort of dismantling their lives,
right.
People who are sort of faced with economic precarity.
Right.
People who are really affected by gentrification, which is such a big thing in so many cities across the country. So,
right.
But really, it's a story of friendship and sex and activism and pleasure and yep. things kind of falling apart and coming back together.
Right. And, you know, you have a nice, within these three characters that you mentioned, Stevie, Mel, and Johanna, you really do have a kind of a broad range or spectrum of these three women in different situations, you know, in different circumstances. And without giving anything away to our listeners, there is one incident that sort of brings them together. Actually, that I think brings Stevie and Johanna together. They witness something together. But one of the things I wanted to ask you was why was it important to set Occupy Wall Street as the backdrop to these lives?
Yeah, well, I went to Occupy quite a bit. I wasn't an occupier. I mean, I didn't stay overnight. But I think, like many New Yorkers and many people across the country, I was really taken with the movement. I study youth activism, and I teach a course on youth activism. And I just thought, you know, here's this really unique and special attempt at creating a sort of utopian anarchist space with collective leadership and, you know, a lot of hard work going on, but also they had the people's library and they had the people's kitchen and there was dancing and there was, you know, a real kind of spirit of collaboration, which I think was really fascinating. And I wanted to just think more about that site because, or that moment, because I think it was the beginning of a lot of economic conversations that we're having right now. You know, I think they were really good at sort of moving us away from student debt shame and sort of shifting the narrative about the 99% and the 1%. So I feel, you know, some people think Occupy was a failure, but I actually think, like many social movements, it just has fed into other ones and has had a lot of really interesting offshoots you can see happening all over the world today.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that as well. I remember, you know, being... I didn't physically go to the Occupy, Occupy there in New York City, but I witnessed it, you know, just through whatever I could see in the media. But even then, hearing that at the time I was living in Colorado and working in Denver, so I was there quite a bit and having conversations with colleagues and folks in the community. And, you know, that was kind of a general sentiment was that, oh, yeah, it's a great start to something that sort of fizzled out and died and was unsuccessful. That was kind of the narrative of it. But I didn't feel that way at all. I felt like, you know, sometimes these kinds of movements happen in layers in which, you know, it's just the mission or the purpose of one to sort of crack open the first layer so that other things can sort of be born from that. And I feel that way. I think you're absolutely right. I feel that way about what Occupy was able to sort of. It was really kind of a cracking open of a sort of a next level of consciousness, you know, across the country, and enabled us to have some of the things that we're some of the movements that we're seeing now, particularly. And one of the ones I wanted to bring up was the Me Too movement in regards to these characters. You know, how much of that played a role?
Well,
or if at all.
I think. Like so many women and feminists in this country, or survivors, I should say.
Sure.
I've been really taken with Me Too, and I think it's really changed. It's changed the narrative about what kinds of things can be told in public. And though I don't think we're at the sort of justice accountability place that we need to be, I do think that our ideas of women telling their stories have shifted quite a bit since. You know, Tarana Burke created Me Too, and now it's really evolved. But yeah, I mean, there's another sort of engine, and I don't want to give away too much in the book, but a big engine of the book is something that happens to one of to a student that Stevie doesn't know, but she and Johanna witness what happens to her, and her story is very much sort of a mystery. We don't really know why she's done what she's done. And eventually I think that sort of unfolds into a kind of, parallel Me Too story of some sort, or at least something that is ambiguous and problematic from her perspective. So, yeah, I think that anytime you have female femme characters who are navigating a world of dating, issues of assault, I think, are always going to come up, and I think they're very much lurking in this book, and also for Johanna, who's in a pretty abusive relationship with her boyfriend.
Right, and yeah, and like I said earlier on this description, you pull no punches, and I mean that in every sense of that. You know, in fact, you know what? Before I continue talking, why don't we have you share an excerpt for our readers? I mean, for our listeners, for your readers, but our listeners.
Yeah, I'm happy to. So I'm going to read from the later part in the book. So this is Johanna, the young homeless woman that I was just speaking of. And
can you tell me what page that's on so I can follow?
Yeah, I'm on page 234.
Okay.
It's called You and Your Little Dog, Too. And she has lost track of her boyfriend. They sort of don't know where each other is. And I think this is sort of a, you know, this is a common problem in homeless populations. It's like just keeping track of all your people is so difficult.
Right.
So I'm going to start. You and your little dog, too. Tipsy, Johanna called out to the park. Tipsy, she shouted louder as she walked the curved path that led to the fountain. Have you seen my dog? She asked a group of students. She's a pit bull mix, black and white spots like a small cow. They shook their heads blankly at her, like she wasn't speaking English, like she was a ghost they were staring through. You lost your little dog, someone sing-songed at Johanna. It was the crazy old lady who sometimes shouted at her in Butch about the apocalypse. Johanna took a long look at her. She had a stiff gray helmet of hair, full of life, probably 30, but looked 50, tanned, hard leather face, new Doc Martin boots that one of the Ritchies who lived in the townhouses on the north side of the park must have given her, an old black cocktail dress, pink puffer jacket stained with piss. She had a kind of chic Hag Street style that Johanna admired, but she was utterly screwed, no friends, batshit, in need of major mess. For a second, Johanna wanted to steal her boots. She remembered her name was Kathy. You lost your little dog, Kathy cooed and patted the bench for Johanna to sit next to her. She scanned the park for Butch's lanky, lately skeletal frame. Butch had said he'd look too, but he probably left the score. He lied about everything now. He'd come back from the emergency room like nothing had happened, like he hadn't nearly died while she stood over his twitching corpse. He wouldn't even talk about it with her. She sat down next to Kathy. You and your little dog, too, Kathy said. Do you remember the witch and the Wizard of Oz? Johanna shook her head no. They were having a lucid moment. I'll get you, my pretty, and your little dog, too, the witch said to Dorothy. I never saw that movie, Johanna said, but she knew about the Yellow Brick Road and Somewhere Over the Rainbow, a song she hated so much she'd never been able to listen to the whole of it. Her mother had once played it, and she'd run out of the cabin and into the snow to get away from the despairing hope of it. Kathy put her hand on Johanna's back and patted, patted, patted. Johanna heard a voice in her head, you suck, you're a failure, you can't do this alone. She heard it sometimes when she was alone, when she wasn't using, when things were getting messed up. It was more persistent lately, a hissing in her ear rather than an occasional aside. You suck, you're a failure, you can't do this alone. You suck, you're a failure, you can't do this alone. Johanna winced. She didn't want any comfort. She didn't want life either, but here they were. I used to be like you. I had a dog too, Kathy said, a poodle. He had a purple bandana. I made a lot of money because of that dog. She was a good dog, Johanna hunched over her knees and cried into her hands. For Tipsy and all of the strays. For the idea that she could become Kathy or that Kathy had once been like her. How easy it was to go from beatnik hobo to homeless hag. Kathy patted, 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 and shouted at a woman jogging by with a stroller, the world is ending, don't you know?
And if you're just tuning into Words on a Wire, that is the voice of novelist Carly Moore, who is reading from her debut novel titled The Not Wives, which you can find with Feminist Press based out of New York. And Carly, you know, one of the questions that sort of came up to me right now as you were reading this, in fact, I think throughout, even when I was reading the book, that there are, I wondered how much of these, because you seem to know the characters very well, you know, not just the setting mm-hmm. and the geography, but also the characters, you know, were some of these characters composites of people you knew? And if so, I'm wondering, have they read it and what do they think?
Yeah, this question has come up a lot.
Yeah, because they're such powerful characters, you know, they're very vivid.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and it's a really good question. I love this question. So Stevie, you know, is loosely based on myself, although she very much, you know, becomes a fictional character.
Right.
But I, too, teach at a university and don't have tenure and have a kid. Right. Identify as queer and bisexual.
Right.
And Mal is based on a bunch of different friends of mine. So, she's really definitely a composite of people. And then Johanna is just, you know, if you, you know, I think, as I was mentioning, you know, major cities, but there are, you know, teens all over cities who are, you know, homeless and mm-hmm. and getting by either panhandling or sometimes, you know, using and sometimes not. A lot of them are queer. And I've just always really been cared very much about and also just been really interested in that group of teens who, you know, has a pit bull on a rope and is sort of, they're homeless, but they're also sort of championing a kind of way of life or a sort of resistant mode to capitalism.
Right.
So, yeah, they're all around.
Well, I imagine that from the readings you've been giving us and all of that, the events that you've had around this, the receptions, I can't imagine that the reception hasn't been more than, you know, welcoming, and probably, you know, a lot of folks really looking forward to what you have in store down the road as well. How's the reception been on your end?
Oh, it's been really lovely.
Good.
I mean, you know, Feminist Press is, they're one of the bigger independent presses. And,
right.
They've done a really great job with the book and with publicity, and you know, I've had some really nice tour events, and I had a great launch. And
awesome.
I'm coming to El Paso, so
yeah, and we look forward to having you here. That's on November 21st.
It's fun.
Right, November
21st. Yeah, November 21st and November 22nd.
Awesome. And November 22nd, is that the literary event?
Yeah, that's the literary event.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, folks here locally know literary. We all know literary and love that place. And so we look forward to meeting you in person and to listening to what and seeing what you've got in store for us down the road.
Okay. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much, Carly. And take care of yourself.
Okay, you too. Bye.
Bye-bye. Welcome to the second part of our show today. We have here in the studio with us special guest, local El Paso activist Diana Martinez, and professor as well, who will be speaking with about an exciting documentary that we will have It'll have a couple of showings here in El Paso, one on the UTEP campus and another one at the Alamo Movie Theater here locally. And we'll talk more about that in a bit. But first, I'd like to welcome Diana to Words on a Wire.
Hello, Tim. Thank you for having me here.
Have you ever been on the show before?
No, I've never been on radio before.
Oh wow, really? Yeah, but you're an active listener, right?
Well, I've been interviewed and, you know, for print media. Mm-hmm. I've been interviewed for print media and interviewed on, you know, like local channel news. So, yeah.
Right. Well, we're excited to have you here and to talk about this documentary. Before I get into some of the questions for you about this, I want to just give our listeners a little background about who you are and what you do. You were born and raised here in El Paso. You've got 2 degrees in history, and you also teach American history at the El Paso Community College and here at UTEP, right?
Yes.
And you also participated heavily in the movement to shut down the Children's Detention Facility at Tornillo last fall, which is the subject of this documentary titled Witness at Tornillo. So, why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about Tornillo and how your involvement got started with that?
I had been paying attention to it during the spring of 2018.
Right.
And, and I saw the news of Merkley at an old Walmart. And how that was a child detention center.
Right.
And then I heard about it coming to El Paso. And then finally, well, not to El Paso, but to Tornillo, which is right outside of El Paso.
Right.
And then finally the news came that it had opened. And that was in June or July.
Last summer.
It was last summer. And everybody was just like, you know, we have a human rights issue right in our own backyard.
Right.
And I was trying to figure out, like, how do we mobilize a lot of people to, you know, to do something about this?
Right.
We can't have something that's right in our own backyard and sit at home and do nothing. And so, like, how do we connect all the people who know each other? Because El Paso, everybody knows everybody,
right.
You know? And so I started a group called SOS for Detained
right.
Children,
right.
And it's mainly about education, brainstorming of what to do. It's a closed group.
Right.
People can request to join, but I didn't want a lot of trolls
this
disrupting.
Is on social media,
yeah, it's
right?
on
yeah.
social media,
right.
on Facebook.
Right.
I don't want a lot of trolls disrupting what we're doing in terms of thinking and brainstorming what we can do for
right.
these children in detention. And so, yeah, so it's a, kind of like a brainstorming group, information group. And so, yeah, where we share informative, useful articles or we share different events that are going on that have to deal with this, like such as protest.
Right.
So, yeah.
You know, when I first became aware that Tornillo was taking place right here outside of El Paso, I'm new to El Paso still. I've been here for about 4.5 years now. But when I became aware of what was happening, I didn't realize how close Tornillo, Texas was to El Paso, you know. But when I realized that, and I had heard about it on the news and kind of kept it on my radar, obviously, but when I realized it was so close, it was like 30 minutes drive or 35 minute drive from my house, it was like, how can I not, you know, be a part of whatever it is to shut that down? And I remember I drove out there with my two kids. I just one Saturday drove out there to kind of look at it and to just witness what was happening, just to say I've seen it and I know what's going on, and, you know, not thinking of it beyond that, just kind of going out there and just to look, you know. And then that's when I first met a man out there who was standing alone. Mm-hmm. With a sign and a lawn chair, a white man, and there was an RV parked, and his name was Joshua Rubin. And I went up to him and I said, "Hi, my name's Tim." He said, "I'm Joshua." And I said, "Great." And then I said, "What are you doing out here?" And he just said, "I'm just standing here so they know that we're watching." Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, that's incredible. So I kind of left him alone because you just didn't know at first. Like, what is he really trying to do here? I was not sure. So I just held the signs and freed the children. And that was my first introduction to Joshua. What was yours like?
Well, it was a Families Belong Together March, and that was downtown. And there was a lot of us. And mm-hmm. there are people who came from all around the country for that march. Uh-huh. There's about 1,500 people, and it was so beautiful to see all those people there, Matachinas dancing, yeah. You know, all the different major organizations came together, and we came right up there to the bridge. And after the march had finished, I was going back to my car. I was volunteering for the Women's March, and I was getting people signed up, mm-hmm. and that's how I ran into Josh Rubin. I was like, "Hey, do you want to sign up?" Yeah. And he's like, "Well, I'm from Brooklyn." I don't know, I'm not really involved in the local women's march here in El Paso. Right. And so I told him, I was like, "Oh, well, thank you for coming all the way from Brooklyn down here." And I gave him directions to his car, and we started talking mm-hmm. about meeting for coffee. We met for mm-hmm. coffee. We talked a little bit more. He's like, "I think I want to come down here. I want to come back down here. And even if it's just me standing on the side of the road with a sign, this just says free them," yeah. you know? And even if I'm just like alone by myself and that's it,
right.
you know, at least somebody will see.
Right.
And part of the detention center that was at Tornillo is very desolate. Right. It was very far yeah. out of the way, yeah. not yeah. where a lot of people can see that it was there.
Yeah.
You really
very intentionally
have to,
out of yeah. the way. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, so that was my first encounter with Joshua Rubin. And, well,
yeah,
in August and September, everything kind of went in a lull. The news cycle, right. it went down in the news cycle. It didn't get as much attention. And we're just like, well, how do we keep the momentum going? Because those kids are still there.
Right.
And when Josh Rubin came down in October, he came October, November, December, until early January, and he really brought more of a spotlight onto the situation. Yes,
yeah, he did. You know, and that was one of the things that compelled me to then pay more attention was the fact that there was this white man from Brooklyn came all this way who was just sitting there by himself, and he said those exact same words to me. He says, "If it's just me here, you know, they'll know that I'm here." And I see how many buses go by. And then pretty soon I started to follow him on Facebook. And then it got even more sort of compelling because he was posting, as he was witnessing, he was posting what he was witnessing. And then you couldn't, if you followed him, you could not help but suddenly think to yourself, why am I not there? Why am I not, you know, present as well with him, standing, witnessing as well? And he did. You're right. He stayed there for about four months around there in an RV on site. I remember because I invited him to the show after going out there a couple of times already and talking with him and getting to know him. I said, "Do you want to come on our show to talk about this?" And he said, "Yeah, but I'm a little conflicted because part of why I'm here is to be here witnessing." Yeah. Go over there on the show. But we did. We got him here for a little bit. came on the show and we talked about it. He found it important enough to do that. So that was a really good good plus for the a positive thing for us and for the movement there. And he went back and then we aired the show. We got a really great response from it. And maybe we'll even link it to this interview here because this is what the documentary is about, right? At some point, someone along the way decided to, because a lot of us were taking photos and things like that out there. But at some point, someone decided to keep a camera on him. And how did that evolve?
Well, I think it was Andy Klein. So Andy Klein, I don't know how Andy Klein found out about Joshua Rubin. I think, I don't really remember quite where Andy Klein is from.
But he's not from El Paso.
Yeah, not from El Paso. Okay. But again, somewhere back up north. And so, the film documentarian, Andy Klein, with Carbon Trace Productions.
Well, we're out of time, unfortunately, and I know we can go on and on talking about this, but people will have the opportunity to talk with, there'll be Q&A sessions and talk with the Joshua and talk with, you know, organizers like yourself there at these events. So make sure you go out there. But I'd like to close. I want to give you the opportunity to close with a poem that you have.
Oh, okay. All right, here we go. We go back real quick. All right, here we go. Yes, I got it. Yes. Okay. It's very important that we create an image of immigrants and migrants that is positive, that humanizes who we are. Dehumanizing migrants and immigrants makes things like child detention possible. And so I have a story about our contribution to this country and our sacrifice. And it's about really, it's about something that's really very close to home. So I'll read it to you. A Mexican rosebush grows strongest in the desert. La familia grows sweet and strong despite the pain. We survived from the sporadic desert rain. Both my parents were born of Mexico, but one survives. The bloodshed in the jungle reverberated through our lives. My father, a Mexican resident, fought and killed Vietnamese for Estados Unidos. Mother married in love's light from Juarez to El Paso. She took flight. She crossed the river. Adios, hermanos. She bore her children to be citizen in Los Estados. Our family crosses the river to be together. Somos de dos lados. In the day, father reveled in the study of flight, but it was Vietnam that haunted him in the night. For the price of our citizenship, his sanity was the cost. As for many men whom returned from war, something was lost. 10 years prior, he was in the Vietnam War. The mental burden was too much to keep his life. When he departed, the family was struck with strife. The continued consequences of that war my family, my mother, bore. With strength and dignity, she persisted. As a nurse, she indiscriminately saved people's lives. Even when her children grew to be nurses and educators, she refused to be rested. Through her honorable work, our family did arise. Under the sun and moon, she worked like nobody else can. Of course, she was born a Mexican. Pink rose bushes, still she does grow. A Mexican rose bush grows strongest in the desert. It's something now you know.
That is the voice of Diana Martinez. Thank you, Diana, for coming on our show. It's really been a pleasure to have you. And I'd like to thank our two special guests, Carly Moore, pick up her book, The Not Wives, and Diana Martinez again for talking about the documentary Witness That Tornillo, which you can find more of that on our website at ktep.org. Also like to thank our producers, Sam Casiano and Dee Wu. That wraps it up for this edition of Words on a Wire. We'll see you next week, same time, same place here on KTEP 88.5 FM.